Today is the 12th of June 2018. I'm interviewing Diane Veronese Karam, part of her family, particularly the Grocott-Edgecombe connection. Diane, would you like to start off and tell us something about the history of your family?
Right, well, my father was Robert Ernest Edgecombe. My mother was Betty Marion Grocott. Their parents all came out to New Zealand in the mid-1960s. My father's mother was Annie Mackay. She came out on a boat called the Strathallan, which landed in Napier in 1864. The Edgecombes all came out from England, from Cornwall, in the mid-1860s as well. My grandparents met and married in Takapau in southern Hawke's Bay and were farmers. My grandmother died in childbirth when my father was only about three, and my grandfather remarried, and he and his second wife went on to have three more children, and they shifted to a farm in Waimarama. My father worked on the farm for quite a few years, but then as a result of a misunderstanding with his stepmother, he stormed off the farm, came into town to Hastings, and eventually went to work at the Tamina Freezing Works, which was owned by the Nelson family. So they arrived in the 1860s, and I'm not sure what boat they came on, but that probably doesn't matter too much. Prior to that, they'd been a well-known Cornish farming family. They had come over from France with William the Conqueror in 1066 and subsequently acquired a lot of land through their support of the various monarchs right through the ages. They were granted lands mainly in Cornwall and were one of the largest landowners in England at one time. From the mid-1300s to the end of the 1500s, they owned a very beautiful manor house in Cornwall called Cotele, and that's C-O-T-E-H-E-L-E. They decided to shift from there and built another manor house on the shores of Plymouth Sound, and it's called Mount Edgecombe House. But that was destroyed during the war by an incendiary bomb. Fortunately, all the portraits were in storage in London at the time, but a new house was built after the war on the same site, and we have visited that several times. So being members of the Edgecombe family, we have been given the grand tour, shown all the treasures, and the present Earl of Mount Edgecombe is actually a New Zealander who is a sheep farmer from the Bay of Plenty. During the war, the beach below Mount Edgecombe House was concreted, and that was where the boats left for Dunkirk. The holder of the title at the time, the Earl of Mount Edgecombe, Baron Edgecombe, had a son called Piers, and because of the son being very much alive, the younger brother decided to come to New Zealand too, because he thought he would never inherit the title. But unfortunately, Piers, the son of the Earl at the time, was killed at Dunkirk, which was quite ironic, seeing all the boats had left from the bottom of their property. So the younger brother was already in New Zealand, and his nephew is now the 8th Earl of Mount Edgecombe, the 10th Baron Edgecombe, and he had five daughters, and the title after he dies will pass to somebody who's in Canada, which the English family are all a bit peeved about. But there was a wee bit of a scandal involved with the New Zealand Baron, or Earl, when he inherited the title in the mid-1980s. The family were still living in the house at that time, and they have a beautiful garden, amazing garden, and it's visited by the public, and it's a very large garden and is considered one of the great gardens of Cornwall. His wife, the Countess, whose name I think was Joan, after 2 years of obviously admiring the garden and admiring the gardener, took off with the gardener. So she and the Earl eventually divorced. I don't know what's happened to her in the meantime, but anyway, she's got the gardener, if she no longer has the garden.
Coming back to the New Zealand connection, was there any relationship between him and Edgecombe? And
there is, but it's quite obscure. He is another branch. It is the same family, but he is a different branch.
Okay.
So when the Edgecombes did come to New Zealand, most of them became sheep farmers, and my father was working on the family farm at Waimarama, and at around about 1936 or 7, he left the farm under acrimonious circumstances and came into Hastings and went to work at the freezing works.
Was his father running the farm?
His father owned the farm. His father was Ernest Edgecombe, and his mother had been Annie Mackay, who had died, but his stepmother was Agnes Frame. He then met my mother, I think, at a dance. My mother at the time was about 18, and they had very good friends that they did everything with, and they were all married within a very short space of time. My mother was Betty Marion Grocott, and her parents were Bill Grocott, William Charles Grocott, and Ruth Butcher. So we're tied up with the Butcher family too. Now my grandfather, Bill, was born down on the west coast in Rimu, and he was the eldest of 8 children. His father was a gold miner with a claim down a shaft, and every fortnight he'd wash up the gold and cycle 5 miles into Hokitika to sell it. He also built a smithy and he shoed horses on Saturdays. Sundays were reserved for church and family time. His mother, who was a nasty old woman, made oilskin coats for the workers at the Otera Tunnel. She made them from unbleached calico on a treadle sewing machine, and then once sewn, a neighbour would oil them. She also made lambies for the men. These were long, loose flannel chemises to keep out the cold. Grandad and his brother Harry were 17 and 18 when they decided to leave. They came to Hastings to learn butchery. They worked for a butcher in Hastings called J.B. Fletcher, who was well known at the time. A few years later, Grandad bought his own butcher shop in Hastings and he married Ruth.
Where was that butcher shop?
Down the far end of Heratonga Street. Do you know where Fletcher's butcher shop was? Further down from Tobin's.
Okay.
So the shop was down in Heratonga Street West. I made a mistake before. My grandmother's mother was butcher. She was Ruth Eldershaw. So eventually the rest of the Grocott family left Rimu and decided to settle in Havelock North. My grandparents had 7 children and my mother was the 2nd eldest. It was quite a close family, and I remember as a child going to my grandparents every Sunday for Sunday dinner, and all of us children would put on plays for the adults, which was a lot of fun, especially as I was an only child. My elder cousin, who I had a lot to do with, was an only child. So having the chance to mix with all these cousins was a lot of fun.
Was Digby a cousin of yours?
No, Digby is a 2nd cousin.
Okay.
Digby was my Uncle Walter's grandson.
Okay.
So that's sort of back on the Edgecombe side.
Well, your grandparents had the horse stud and Crosses Road, didn't they?
No, Roma. Well, that was where we used to go on Sunday nights.
Yes.
And that was built in 1938. And my mother was married from there in 1938. And not very long ago, the people who bought that house were doing some relining of the garage or something like that, and they found a piece of wood tucked away inside the framework, and it had on it the date that the house was completed and the price that they had paid for it, that it had cost, and it was £1,100.
I know.
And it was a big house. So, yes, he owned a racehorse stud, which I think he sort of felt himself was quite an achievement for a boy from the coast.
Fast horses or slow horses?
Oh, no, I think they were pretty fast. As children, we weren't allowed to go anywhere near the stallions because they were too dangerous.
Yes.
But my grandfather did have Shetland ponies there too for all of us grandchildren to ride. So I sort of learnt to ride down there and loved it and probably haven't ridden for the last 65 years.
So where were you living as a family at that stage?
Parents and I?
Yes.
We actually lived just opposite my great-grandmother in Ellison Road when I was little. And then during the war, we had a property down in Ada Street, and my parents were growing potatoes. I'm not quite sure why this was considered part of the war effort, but it was. But the very first crop that they sowed, they had a terrible flood, dreadful, dreadful winter, and they came out of it with absolutely no money at all. All the potatoes rotted. But I do remember my grandfather, every Saturday, would go into, was it Clary Watson's in Frederick Street in Hastings? They used to make their own sweet. He had a soft drink factory.
So that was C.C. Watson.
They also used to make their own sweets.
Yes.
And every Saturday, my grandfather would do the rounds of all of us children with a bag of raspberry drops and peppermint. What were those other peppermint things?
Not black balls.
Yep, they did black balls, raspberry drops, black balls, and the big peppermint things too. I can't remember their names. Anyway, that was his Saturday morning ritual to just come around all of us, which we all appreciated.
So you started school at Havelock North?
Well, after Ada Street, we shifted to a house in St Albans Street. I was going to Parkvale School. My very first year was at Parkvale School. By the end of that year, my mother and her sister had decided to open a dress shop in Hastings. A very exclusive dress shop, I might add, called Susan Brown. And they had a workshop out the back. They employed five girls out there, all on their sewing machines, making all the clothes for the shop. And so if the ladies of Hawke's Bay were off to the races, they went to Susan Brown because they knew that they would get a one-off dress.
Right.
An exclusive. So they did become very popular, and they ran that shop for about 10 years, I suppose, and then my mother decided to take up golf, got very interested in that, and they closed the shop. But at that time, my cousin, whose mother was in business with my mother, was at school in Havelock North at St Luke's, which was a little school in behind the present church. So I was also sent to school out here in Havelock at St Luke's. The little school room that we were in is now the op shop, which is a shifted and situated at the front of the property. And we had no more than six girls in each class. It was a girls' school. Although we had boys in the primers, and Paul von Dadelson was one of the boys. There was another boy called Ross Bush, whose father owned the grocery shop. I know that his father used to cure all his own bacon out the back of the shop. I love it. So for that first year, I was actually sent out to Havelock North to board with a lady up the top of Busby Hill called Mrs. Doyley, because my mother and aunt were both going to be so busy that my cousin Janice and I both came out here and were boarding. So at that point, there were two rooms. There was the standards room, which is now the op shop, and there's another little room called the green room, which was where all the primers went. And I think the green room is still there.
Yes, it is.
That didn't get shifted or anything.
No.
So it was a super little school, really lovely little school. And every day we had 20 minutes of chapel in the church before school. On Fridays, Canon Weymouth, who was the clergyman there at the time, would come and take chapel. The rest of the week, Mrs. Miller, Frances Miller, who was the headmistress, would. I don't know why she was the headmistress, there were only two teachers, one for the primers and one for the standards. Anyway, she would take chapel for the rest of the week. Canon Weymouth, who I can still see floating down from the vicarage,
yes,
which in those days was up in Campbell Street, and he would come striding down through the paddock that is now part of Havelock North School, but at that point
yes,
it was just an empty paddock. So there was quite a bit of rivalry between Havelock North School and St Luke's School, and lots of yelling over the fence, but I think in general we probably all got on okay.
Yeah.
Frank was probably one of those that I almost
never,
used
no,
to yell across.
Terrified of girls, they didn't play a part in their lives.
So after that I went to Hastings Boys High.
So did you do all your primary schooling
at St Luke's?
Oh, I didn't realise that. I thought you'd only been there for a while.
No,
that's
no, I was at St Luke's for the whole...
So
I've had first year at Park.
You're
Park.
A proper old girl of
yeah,
the green room.
In fact, I left at the end of 1952, and Frances Miller, who was the person who held the school together, left to go to Queen Margaret's, I think, down in Christchurch. She went to a Christchurch school, one of the more prestigious ones, and shortly after she left, the school kind of folded up. It probably struggled on for another 3 years, maybe. I'm not too sure about that. But yes, the whole thing folded, and later on, of course, the ground where the school was became St Luke's Close. It was a little, what do you call it? A wee retirement settlement.
Yes. So then you went to Arkina, which was a joint boys and girls
in those days, Hastings High School. So I was there until the Hastings Girls High School started up. Then I left and went to work at Fernware.
Did you play any sports at all?
Yes. I was in the girls' first 11 cricket. I played a lot of netball, did quite a lot of swimming, but probably cricket and netball were my two. Well, we had several cricket teams, actually, the girls, but I was obviously good enough to make it to the first 11, so, and I loved cricket and still enjoy watching it, frustrating though it can be.
So you moved on to Fernware, where you started?
As a secretary. Probably started as an office junior, if the truth be known. And I was there for about 10 years, I suppose.
And Fernware, they used to make school chairs.
Their biggest money spinner at the time that I started there was actually kitchen units. And then soon after I started there, they started making tubular furniture, and the school furniture was the main thing that they were making,
yes,
tables
yes,
and chairs. And they relied on government contracts and, well, education board contracts, but then they were all government anyway, weren't they? So they had quite a large factory, and it was tucked in between Queen Street and Heratonga Street in the block between Nelson Street and Karamu Road, and it took up probably about a quarter of that whole block.
So who was the brains behind Fernwood?
People who were running it. That my boss was Bruce Cowan.
So was he the man who owned it?
No, it was a publicly owned company, and Bruce Cowan and Roy Skiptrip were the joint managing directors, and people like old Barton Hobbs, Russell Pettigrew were directors. Can't remember the other directors at the time, but it was considered to be a good enough investment for my mother to buy shares in it at that time.
So 10 years there.
10 years there. By then I was married.
Well, okay. So where did you meet your husband? His name was
Edric Montgomery Gilmore. My parents were very keen on golf, and they played at a little course way down on Oahu Road called Parkvale. I can't think of the name of the road. Anyway, it was a little nine-hole course called Parkvale. And one evening they came home with this young man who was a young chemist, and he was doing a bit of locum work in the area. He was from Christchurch. And they brought Ed home for tea. They'd played golf with him that day, and he was just sort of new to the area. And he was doing a locum for the chemist down the road from us called Ron Wilson. So Ed came to our place with my parents for tea that night, and he never carried on to anywhere else. He stayed
yes.
in Hastings and got a permanent job with Mate Richardson, who owned a chemist shop in Heratonga Street, up the King Street.
Was he Graham's father?
Graham's father.
Mm. Mate.
Matty, actually. Also, Matty is really a Croatian name.
Right.
So he was always known as Mate, but he probably was Croatian.
Yeah.
I must ask Graham sometime, actually.
Yes.
Because he was Matty. So Ed worked for Mate for about 4 years,
mm.
and then he got a job out here in Havelock North with Donald Syme. Don was wanting to retire from pharmacy and run his orchard, was he?
Yes, he had a peach orchard.
Anyway, he was a bit sick of pharmacy, so he employed Ed as a manager. And we got married, and the first time I ever went to Taupo was in a little Morris 8 car that Ed had bought. And we went to Rotorua for our honeymoon. So that was my first ever trip on the Taupo Road, which at that stage was half pumice, all corrugations.
Yes.
So the little Morris 8 car, by the time we got to the other end, we were pretty full of dust.
And so Ed carried on with the pharmacy in the village.
Mm-hmm. I was still working for Fernware at
that
time. That's
right.
What was called furniture and woodware in those days.
And then children.
We were married 6 years before our first son, Peter, was born. 2 years later came Joanne, and then 3.5 years after that was Simon. And Simon fulfilled all Ed's dreams. He was the child who was keen on golf and very good at it. He was the fisherman of the family, which was a passion of Ed's, and became a passion of Simon's, and still is to this day. We had lots of family holidays that involved fishing, and Simon and Ed would go off together with their rods while the other children and I lay around the beach and did all kinds of things like that. Family holidays were always a lot of fun. We did lots of camping. I have one particular memory of camping right on the beach at Opotiki in an old, what do you call those tents with the frames?
Yes,
the old frame tent, anyway. And we were camped under a pahutakawa tree, and lots of electrical storms in the Bay of Plenty. And we'd only just arrived, and Ed and Peter had pitched the tent. There was a storm, and the tree above the tent was struck by lightning and caught fire, which caused a lot of amusement with the children. So there were lots of holidays like that. Many holidays over in Taupo with two other families, and Christmases were spent a lot of the time with two other families.
It was really very much a family time. There was three other families that came.
Yes, there were.
You know, those namely were the Coopers and the Karens.
Yes, exactly. So
and
there were lots of boating holidays in those days,
yes,
because the Karens
yes.
owned a fizz boat, and so all the children learnt to water ski and became very proficient. Simon in particular, once again, he's always been pretty sporty.
And during this period of time, you still maintained your golf interest and became pretty good at it, didn't you? Those days you were playing for Bridge Par.
Bridge Par. I took up golf when Simon, my youngest child, went to school in 1977. And I loved it. Played lots of days a week, probably at least 3 days a week, and did become reasonably proficient. Managed to struggle to single figures for a short time, but played on a 10 handicap for a long, long time, which on worldwide standards is considered pretty good. Eventually I became the paid secretary of the golf club, and that was really when my golf started going downhill, because I was too much in the office and not enough on the golf course.
Later on you were secretary for a local MP, namely Mr.
Jeff
Whittaker.
That was at the time that Ed and I divorced. It then became necessary for me to earn a living, so Jeff Whittaker offered me a job. He was newly elected MP for Hastings, as the electorate was known at the time. And he offered me the job of electorate secretary, which was a lot of fun and very enlightening. And man, oh man, could I tell you a few stories about Winston Peters, who's now going to be running our country for the next 6 weeks. Boy.
No.
Jeff used to ring me at times at 11 in the morning with some hair-raising tales about sharing the lift with Winston.
Now, coming back to the children, what are they doing when they left school?
When Peter left school, he didn't really know what he wanted to do. He went to work for you, Frank, on the orchard. Then he actually went to Australia. Actually, he enjoyed his time with you.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the boy, Scott?
Adam
Scott. He became very friendly with him. But he was still only 18, not quite 19,
right,
when he decided to go to Australia. So off he went with a friend. The two of them went off to Australia and were doing all kinds of jobs. When he came back, about 5 years later, he set up his own horticultural business, pruning and picking and all that kind of thing. But he had always been friendly through his school years with a young boy called Thad Lawrence, who was Bruno Lawrence's son. And through the connections with Bruno, Peter shifted up to Auckland and became a gaffer on a TV program at the time called, what was it, The Warrior Princess? What was her name? Xena Warrior Princess. So he became a gaffer on that. And after a while, he started buying his own lighting trucks, and he now owns 7 lighting trucks that work for him rather than him working for them these days. So he's now married and has 5 boys, the last of whom were twins that were supposed to be one girl but turned out to be 2 more boys. The oldest boy is Thad, and he was born while Peter was in Australia. He lives in Nelson. He's now 29 years old, and he has an adopted son with his wife Angela. From her first relationship, he has this boy called Hayden, who takes after Peter in so many ways, in his work ethic, in everything he does. He's a very hard working young man. And the 3 children that he had with Angela are Toby, who is now in seventh form at school. He's 17. And the twins have just started high school. They've just turned 14 in April. And their names are Felix and Jasper.
Then Joe.
So Joe, after she left school, also did secretarial work and has worked for accountants all her life. She worked for Coopers and Lybrand in Hastings for quite a few years. And then she worked for Brown Webb and Co. And it was while she was there that she decided to go to England. She was in a relationship that she wasn't happy about, and neither was I. Simon, by that stage, had already gone to England, so she went to England to join him. Once again, went to work in London for accountancy firms and ended up marrying Simon's friend, James, who was in London also with Simon. And they have 2 boys, Henry, who is now 20, and Max, who is still at school, is coming up to 18, he's 17 at the moment. And Joe is still working for a firm of accountants in Newmarket in Auckland.
Yes.
James, unfortunately, 12 years ago, had a major car accident. So he, at the time, was working for Peter in the lighting industry, but he now works for a firm who does lighting for events. He's restricted in what he can do, so he works in the storeroom doing all the lighting.
Right.
Simon also went to work for Frank after he left school, and I think then he also worked for Pete when he formed his horticultural gang.
Yeah.
But he didn't enjoy that very much. Mm. And at the time, he had a dear little girlfriend called Belinda, who was very strict with Simon. They had decided they would go to England. She had the ambition to go. Simon had to be prodded and jolted. And Belinda controlled the purse strings until they finally had enough money to go to England. Mm. Simon was allowed 6 cans of beer a week. He could either drink them all at once on the one day, or he could make them last the week. I don't know which he chose to do most of the time, but anyway, that was all thanks to Belinda. And James Bruce, who later became Joe's husband, was Simon's very close friend. And he went with Simon and Belinda to England. And Simon worked at various things. He worked for a firm called the Chelsea Gardener, and they had lots of interesting jobs. At one stage, they were doing garden construction work for Sean Connery. Mm. They had lots of interesting clients because the Chelsea Gardener was sort of very much an upmarket gardening company. So he then started working for a builder, but the building industry took a bit of a downturn in the UK some years ago, probably about the time of the share market crash. Mm. So for the last about 8 years, he's been working for a firm. He does construction type work for a firm that sets up exhibitions all around Europe. And at the moment, he's down in Farnborough, setting up for the Farnborough Air Show. Mm. So that will take 3 weeks. He's just come back from doing something in Amsterdam, and he sets up for things like the Paris Air Show and all those sort of things. So he's got an interesting job at the moment. That he works hard, he works very long hours, but, you know, it's proving to be quite lucrative for him.
Well, that pretty well covers the family, Diane. Now we'll start on your next adventure.
Right, well, in 1992, I married Keith.
Keith who?
Keith Caron, and my whole life changed. My whole life changed. And I changed. I went from being a quiet little mouse. Keith kind of taught me how to fly.
Wonderful.
And it turned into a life of lots of travel, lots of adventure, just doing stuff all the time. And we really haven't looked back since.
Well, I know you've done a lot of travelling.
I had to learn how to ski when I was 52 years old because Keith was a mad keen skier. And so I learnt to ski also, which at 52 took some doing. But we've skied all over the world. We've golfed all over the world.
You have driven the camper van between fishing spots.
Yes.
So
that Keith
didn't have to walk back to recover it.
And so that he can spot fish along the... One time I drove along the canals down in Kekapo, and Keith was hanging off the side so that he could spot the fish and I could screech to a halt.
So you never know until you turn the page in a book. You don't know how the story's going to unfold.
No,
it's wonderful.
Don't.
And so all those other activities, the golfing trips and Croatia. You went to Croatia, didn't you?
We did.
You visits over to see Susan.
And Simon. Keith's daughter Susan and Simon both in London.
And still maintained your golfing interests. Mm. And then you played another game.
Mahjong.
Has it become a habit or a fun thing?
It's a fun thing to do once a week. And we've got a group of 11 in our Mahjong group, and it's just become a nice thing to do, and more contacts soon.
There were a few other things we used to do going back, and that was the Food and Wine Society.
We all belonged to that,
and that was a lot of fun, except it was never about the quality of the wine. It always seemed to be about the
quantity
of wine. The functions we had under the willows, out at Tenants Bend.
Yes.
Happy times.
There was one dress-up dinner we did, didn't we?
Yes.
With the white tablecloths.
That's right.
And everything all under the trees down at the river.
Then there was the golfing tours in New Zealand, and they were a lot of fun.
But we all appreciated the fact that you came along, Frank.
So came the time when you sold Similar Avenue. Where did you move to?
I moved into Joe, my daughter Joe and I moved into a little place in Joel Road that a man called Jack Hickson, in the back there. He built about half a dozen little houses in the back in Joel Road, and Joe and I shifted into one of those.
Yes.
And then I shifted up into Hikanui Drive. Keith had built this house that we're still in, and he'd been here about 6 months, and I shifted up here as well.
And you've been here for?
Well, Keith's been here for 27 years. We've been married 26.
When I was selling real estate, I ran into the main Edgecombe down Murdoch Road. There was a farm down there that used to be owned by...
by Walter Edgecombe. He was my grandfather's brother. He's Digby's grandfather.
Right.
So Uncle Walter owned racehorses as well as, I don't know what else he did. He drank a lot, I know that. But the Edgecombe family have always owned, right through the ages, way, way back, have always named one of their racehorses Cotil, after the original manor house in Cornwall. So there's always been a Cotil owned by the Edgecombe family. And Uncle Walter had one of them, which Digby just reminded me of at Doug's funeral.
Well, Bill Grocott, was he your mother's brother?
One
young
of them,
Bill.
Yes. Young Bill Grocott was... there was Joyce, my mother's eldest sister, then my mother, then there was Bill Grocott, then there was Bruce, then there was another brother, Douglas, always called Tiny, and then there were two girls who brought up the rear called Shirley and Ruth, young Ruth, who was always called Bub. One lovely thing I always remember about my grandfather is that I used to go and stay with them a lot because my parents would go away on holiday and leave me with my grandparents. Every morning at 6:30, my grandfather would come into the bedroom with a cup of tea and a slice of thin brown bread and butter. Now, people don't know about thin brown bread and butter anymore because you buy your bread sliced. In those days, you would butter the bread and then thinly cut a slice off. And he always brought me that every morning when I was staying there. That and the fact that we used to sit around the radio and listen to all those wonderful English comedy radio programs, Munchbinding in the Marsh, and I forget now. But I will always remember my grandmother's cackle of a laugh as we sat around. But also my grandfather never forgot his roots. I think he actually was one of those that formed the West Coasters Club in Hastings. And they met regularly down on a hall in St Albans Street, and my cousin Janice and I would often be taken along, and that was where we learned to dance the Valita and the
Destiny Waltz,
all those things. We all learned how to dance there. My grandfather was a great family man. He was devoted to my grandmother, and he used to always say, "We've been sweethearts for 67 years. She died in her mid-80s, but he kept on going till he was 97. He had also worked at Freezing Works for some of his time, and my father was put in charge of the beef house sort of partway through his time there. Prior to that, my grandfather had been in charge of the beef house. Yes, I've already said that he was born in Remu, but yes, he just never forgot that that was where he had originated.
It's surprising how many people migrated from the coast to
Hawke's Bay, Hastings in particular.
The Longleys, the headmaster of high school, he was from the west, they all were from the west coast.
The Barhams, you mean?
Yes, he grew up on the coast.
Well, he was sort of connected to Ed in a way, because Ed's aunt was the sister to David Barham's grandmother. And wasn't there something tied up about Rhodesia there too?
It could have been actually. Families either came to the west coast when they landed and stayed there and there was work in the mines or in the forest, or you landed at Littleton or Wellington or Auckland.
Or a few in Napier. Not very many came to Napier, but the Mackays did.
All right, well, I think probably, Diane, unless you can think of something else, what are you smiling about?
I'm just smiling about something that my cousin had written to me. She said, Gran, my grandmother, never got her licence, but she used to drive from Havelock to Hastings every Wednesday morning to buy the week's groceries in a Humber Super Snipe. She had no licence. Apparently, she thought it wasn't necessary in those days. If you lived only a certain distance from town, you were allowed to drive. I don't think she got that right, but anyway.
She was never caught.
She was never caught, no. Well, so she must have driven fairly cautiously.
Yes.
Oh, yes. All those years that I came out to Havelock, I used to bike from St Albans Street out here, apart from that year that I boarded in Havelock. I used to bike out from St Albans Street. And while my cousin Janice was still going, she's 5 years older than me, but while she was still going to St Luke's School, sometimes we would get the bus. And she had a little dog, a little black and white cocker spaniel called Buster. Oh no, it was the year that we were boarding with Mrs Doyley. We used to go out on the bus on a Monday morning and come back on the bus on a Friday afternoon. And every Friday afternoon, Buster would be there at the bus waiting for us. He never used to go down any other day, but always waiting on Fridays. So, amazing. Yes. What dogs know.
You're talking about Canon Weymouth, what a straight-up man he was from his little moustache.
And I can remember him striding down through that paddock. On a Friday afternoon, he would come down to teach us scripture. Always taught scripture on a Friday afternoon. So for that he would be dressed in his cassock, and the skirt would be swinging away as he strode down through the paddock.
All right, well, I think that's probably covered up. Thank you, Diane. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Diane's going to tell us some of the things she forgot to tell me.
I forgot to mention that when Simon was in London, he met Natalie Sprott, a girl from Plymouth, who was familiar with our family through the Mount Edgecombe house being on Plymouth Sound. But they married in Plymouth and they live in London. Natalie went to work for the Metropolitan Police on the front line, but however she found that that was not quite what she was suited to, and she now works in HR, still with the Metropolitan Police. But she and Simon have now been married for 21 years. They live near Wembley, in between Wembley and Harrow in London. They have a nice house and a very nice marriage.
Well, that's lovely. Thank you, Diane.